It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour is all about transportation. A little bit later in the hour, we'll talk about the future of transportation, including, maybe you heard about it in the news this week, Google's self-driving car. There's a prototype out. We'll talk about the advances toward self-driving cars, if we actually would even desire to have them. Would you get into a self-driving car where it just took you at the push of a button to wherever you told it to go, I suppose? We'll find out about that in just a few moments. Also, marijuana and driving safety. We'll talk about that. Also, the hazards of all-terrain vehicles to very young Iowans dying this week because of ATV accidents. Also, farm equipment on our roads, the hazards of that. We'll talk about that. And also, we'll move on to the water as we finish up our hour talking about boat safety. We want to reach out to you this hour as well, since technology is our approach for most of this hour, part of this first half hour. I want to ask you about your road pet peeves, your driving pet peeves, and ask you what pet peeves on the road do you wish we could find a technological fix for? And we want to steer you to one of three things, not the phone calls at this point. Let's have you go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, or write us an email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. And once again, what pet peeves on the road do you wish we could find a technological fix for? Let's talk about traffic cameras, the enforcement cameras, red light cameras, speed cameras are continuing to be a topic of debate here in Iowa. Concerns of safety, privacy, and revenue are all mixed up in this discussion. This year, back in February, the Iowa Department of Transportation worked with the state legislature, with cities, and with the public to create a set of rules that now apply to cities with traffic cameras and cities that wish to install the cameras. And we should say the rules only apply to cameras on the primary highway system in Iowa and in U.S. On U.S. interstates. At the start of this month, six Iowa cities, those cities being Cedar Rapids, Council Bluffs, Davenport, Des Moines, Muscatine, and Sioux City, submitted reports to the DOT and are waiting to hear back on whether they can keep the traffic enforcement cameras they currently have in place. Yesterday, we spoke with Steve Gent, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation's Office of Traffic and Safety. His schedule didn't permit him to join us today live. So in our conversation with him yesterday, Gent described how they will decide whether the cities get to keep their cameras.
What we need to do at any given location is really study what crashes are occurring, compare that to other similar locations, and then, you know, to see if it really is a high crash location. Then you study the crashes, the types of crashes, the speeds, the volumes, whether there's turn lanes, you look at the traffic signal timings, et cetera, to really determine what the critical traffic safety issue is. And then you can come up with a whole list of potential countermeasures that can be implemented to make that particular location safer. Cameras, automated enforcement cameras, can absolutely be one of those countermeasures. But it's not the first one we would be looking at. And it's really about, you know, determining whether or not these systems are reducing crashes and maintaining this lower level of crashes.
Steve Gent also talked about why the DOT feels these rules are necessary.
There are 16 states that ban cameras altogether, period. And when you're looking at speed cameras, there's only 12 states in the nation that have at least one speed camera. And there's only 24 states in the nation that have red light running cameras. So really, Iowa is kind of out there in that respect. But one of the biggest keys here is that Iowa is the only state in the nation that all it takes is a simple majority vote of a city council to get cameras. It doesn't cost them a cent. There are companies out there that are lined up waiting to come in to provide cameras for free. And so that's the beauty of having these rules in place, is it allows the DOT to be an objective, oversight on the primary highway system only. Again, on those truly only city or county roadways, they can do whatever they want. But on the primary highway system, the DOT provides a level of oversight that we, you know, just basically ensures the public trust that these systems really are about safety.
And finally, in that conversation with Steve Gent yesterday, Steve Gent of the DOT also responded to criticism from law enforcement that with these limits and regulations, the cameras can only be placed in certain areas. And so then people know where they can and cannot speed, and And of course, they adjust their behavior accordingly. In other words, they say, law enforcement says, they're missing the element of surprise that would reduce speeding everywhere.
Well, certainly that's a concern. You know, if you have a speed camera at one location and it never moves, the locals will know where it's at. They'll slow down for it. It may or may not make it safer in that location. You know, and then that's one of our concerns about, you know, in using these systems on the interstates, because interstates, first of all, they're the safest roadways we have. Second of all, it has a very high percentage of unfamiliar drivers. And so when these unfamiliar drivers, let's just say from Kansas City or Montana or Ohio, are driving through Iowa, they don't read all the signs. And you know, people say, well, there's signs out there saying there's camera enforcement. Well, people don't read all the signs. I often ask people on your drive to work today, how many signs were there and how many of those did you actually read? And usually the answer is one or two out of, you know, a lot. And so people really don't read signs, at least as we all think that they should. And so that's why there's more of a concern on the interstate, and there's also more of a concern on the interstate because that's where really the big revenue has come from, is from the speed cameras on the interstate.
Conversation, excerpts of a conversation with Steve Gent, director of the Iowa Department of Transportation's Office of Traffic and Safety. Yesterday, he couldn't join us live. Joining us, though, now live in our studio, Sue Kreisler is with us, director of research at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. Hi, Sue. Welcome back.
Hi, Ben.
Dan McGeehee is with us as well, director of human factors and vehicle safety research at the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. Welcome back to you, Dan.
Thanks, Ben.
You were listening to the few excerpts we had there from Steve Gent before we get on to talk about some really advanced cars. You can talk about those a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about traffic cameras, these red light and speed cameras. What do we know about how these types of cameras affect safety, Sue?
Well, there's certainly been a lot of experience in other countries. In Australia, they've been around for 40 years. Many countries in Europe have them and have had them for a long time. And there's always different components to safety. We call it the three E's of engineering, education, and enforcement, and I think the cameras provide that an additional level of enforcement. Mm-hmm. But as Steve Gent pointed out, I think we have to do some engineering judgment about where they are best placed and where speed is really shown to be a factor in the crash rate.
So depending on the situation, the speed camera can reduce hazards, can increase safety, but not always?
I think reducing speed will always reduce the crash severity of you know, the likelihood of really getting hurt. So reducing speed is always a good idea. But I think especially in a city location, you know, if there is a lot of pedestrian activity in the area, having a lower speed really has a huge effect on safety, because the difference between hitting a pedestrian going 25 miles an hour where you might injure them, and if you're only going 30 miles an hour, you're going to kill them. Mm. So I think this whole debate is serving an educational purpose as well, and people are talking about it, and I think learning about how speed can affect safety.
One of our listeners, Carver, evidently learned here. This is his email from seconds ago. I find the complaints about traffic cameras to be disingenuous amongst all the other sources of privacy loss in our society today. I got a ticket from a camera on I-235 in Des Moines, and now I watch my speed everywhere in Des Moines much more carefully. The ticket was annoying, sure, but it was effective. So that's a desired outcome.
Yes. And I think that may speak to the idea of people are going to speed elsewhere if they know a camera. But I think it is serving that education of getting, and you have to get a ticket to be educated. But, you know, as your listener points out, it sort of makes one more conscious of your speed.
We're also reaching out this hour to our listeners. What pet peeves on the road do you wish we could find a technological fix for? We'll share some of those coming across Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page right in a few moments, or you can tweet us at IPR Talk. But let's talk a little bit about the self-driving car. Dan, we heard in our news recently about Google's self-driving car. It's for real. The prototype is here. Very cute kind of car that looks like a smallish Volkswagen Beetle, I guess, that has some a little bit of a crown on top with a, I want to say, something like a basketball-sized sensor on its roof. And supposedly with this car, you can reach your destination with the push of a button. You tell it where to go. Dan, now I understand you have in your background some work with automated controls on cars.
Yeah, in fact, the University of Iowa was one of the first universities now 20 years ago to look at what was called at that time the automated highway system. And we did a series of studies here at the then Iowa Driving Simulator, which is now the National Advanced Driving Simulator, that looked at how drivers transition from manual control to automated control. And Google is really just going sort of a step further and just completely automating all parts of driving.
Mm-hmm. So how does that work? I don't trust these things. They're all new things, of course. You don't trust things immediately. So assure me that this technology works by explaining it.
Well, what's quite interesting about what we can see now with the kinds of sensors. So when your listeners will look at some of the video that's in the media about the Google self-driving cars, they'll see a car that looks like an old police gumball on top that's spinning, and that's essentially a scanning laser system, a LiDAR system that's capturing all of the different things in the environment, from pedestrians walking on the sidewalk to other vehicles around approaching and so forth, and essentially is following all of the trajectories of a potential threat. So it really is sort of the ultimate defensive driving car. So it's a very slow driving, a little slower than the regular traffic, but it's really taking in a lot of information to make its decisions on when to brake.
With your expertise and in reading about this, I'm sure you've done a lot of it. What aspects of self-driving cars have proved to be most challenging?
Well, I think ultimately the challenging part is going to be the implementation and the public policy work, and that's what we're very interested in. In fact, Sue and I were in Washington, D.C. a couple of weeks ago and actually met with the head of safety from the Google self-driving car program to talk about some of these issues. And
So to talk about that a little bit, the implementation, because this is a huge new era that we would move into if we could go into the garage, open the car door, and get in. Garage door opens and we tell the car where to go, and I guess we can sit back and read our book, or we can go back to sleep until we get to work. Perhaps the boss is not going to appreciate that, but we could do a lot of things if we knew the car would arrive at our destination 100% accurately.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think there are many generations. I mean, what we're seeing in the media this last couple of days is really the far further out a complete self-driving vehicle. But the things that we're interested in from a policy perspective is what are the thresholds for safety in terms of what scenarios and what sort of challenges do you put in front of a car? And these cars are very eager robots, essentially, and they're taking in every time they drive that roadway to work, they're taking in more and more information to perfect its trajectory.
They're learning.
They're learning all the time. So you can learn a lot from a test track. You get sort of eaten up very quickly, but it's really the open road that they're most interested in capturing data from.
Mm-hmm. Sue, what aspects interest you most?
I think from a technical challenge side, we asked the Google people what they would like more than anything, and the answer was they want to know where the work zones are because they're relying on a lot of map data to traverse the roadway, and if the telephone company is set up in the middle of the road and open the manhole. They don't know that. And so sort of says, oh, I see something in the road, but I don't know what it is. So they don't do well. Some of the sensors don't do well in bad weather. This is most of the testing has been going on in warm weather states. So we would love it if they would come to Iowa and try to drive on our roads in the winter. And you can't maybe see
challenge.
The pavement markings very well.
You would have to have them recognize how tall a snowbank is or slick roads, black ice, all sorts of challenges. There will be decades of challenges. How quickly – when will I likely – what year? Here's a question. What year will I likely look over in the next lane and see a self-driving car?
Well, I think we're seeing some self-driving cars today on the road, but we don't really connect the dots right. So there's something called adaptive cruise control and auto brake and lane tracking systems that are in production today. Almost all of the car companies, have some form of automation. And so it's really about sort of connecting the dots in the shorter term. Volvo, for instance, in Sweden has a big program called Drive Me, which in the next couple of years will have 100 automated vehicles on the road in Gothenburg, Sweden. And so that's a reality that's sort of here today, where you still have a steering wheel and a brake so you can sort of take over. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be a reality that's going to be a shorter term issue. And so companies like Volvo have been pretty bold and said in the year 2020, starting in 2020, they believe that none of their cars will be in at-fault crashes because there is enough automation to brake and anticipate issues that they'll be able to avoid crashes altogether.
Dan McGehee is with us, Director of Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research at the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. Sue Kreisler, Director of Research at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. And Sue and Dan, we've been reaching out to find out what pet peeves on the road our listeners would like a technological fix for. Here's one that fits in with what you were talking about just now, Dan. Evan posted on Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, he wishes we had a tech fix for tailgaters. Now, we wouldn't have tailgating if everybody had a self-driving car. Would that be true, Sue?
Actually, we would not have tailgating if everyone just had adaptive cruise control on their car, which is available now, and that lets you set the distance or time that you want to remain behind that car that's ahead of you. So if they slow down, you slow down.
Mm-hmm. Right, and some of the production vehicles today, once that's on, you can't get any closer to the vehicle ahead. It will just automatically adjust that spacing for you.
James on our Facebook page writes, I'm eagerly anticipating the day that technology renders problems created by, one, inattentive drivers, and, two, inconsiderate drivers to be non-existent, be it driving too slow in the passing lane on the freeways, not giving enough space to other vehicles in traffic jams, or taking extra seconds to let the foot off the brake at stoplights. Humans are terribly inefficient and generally unsafe drivers. There's a claim you two can tackle. Is that true? Will, like Big Blue, that was the computer that beat, Garry Kasparov in chess. Are computers better at driving than humans?
Well, we have to remember that, fatalities on the road is one of the top public health issues that we face, not only in the U.S., but around the world. So these kinds of automation can really help reduce those things. So we're quite excited in the technology.
Is that the main driver,
yes,
as it
absolutely.
Were, for,
yes.
for this change?
Absolutely. We're mm-hmm. very interested in reducing those crash rates, the number of injuries and fatalities, extremely costly to our society.
And can we say now, though, we have to this technology has to develop, but can we say now that absolutely that will be a safer way to go about our driving?
Well,
yes.
If you take a look at – yes, absolutely. 1958 was the first year that we had conventional cruise control in a Chrysler Imperial. And that's really a form of automation if you think about it. It controls the speed of your car once you set that speed. Then it was in the late 90s where we, in production, had this adaptive cruise control, which is much more precise in considering the car ahead of you and slowing you down automatically. And then, like I said before, as you start to connect the dots between these technologies, we start to form sort of a bubble around the car where it will respond if you don't in time.
Mm-hmm. So I'm getting a picture of the future. Let's talk, a couple generations into the future, that the people inhabiting Iowa, the Midwest at that time, will look back at our time and say, can you believe those people drove? They drove their own cars and they had, May, the sign I saw on the interstate, we have over 100 traffic deaths in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And
so far this year,
and that in 5 months, and that they tolerated that level of injury fatality because they didn't have this technology. That is the glimpse that I'm getting, and that's what you're delivering.
And many, Sweden has adopted as a goal zero deaths. They have stated as a national goal that they do not want to have anyone die on the roadway. And Volvo is part of that, and many of the U.S. states, including Iowa, Minnesota was a big leader in this, have programs called Towards Zero Death, and they're really comprehensive safety programs that encompass both driving behavior, which really is the main safety mm-hmm. risk, but also roadway things too.
One of our listeners, Paula, wishes there was a technological fix for the interchange at I-380 and I-80. Very dangerous. You laugh too, Dan. I know it's interchange, so you've got two major thoroughfares connecting, and you've got to feed if you're changing from one to the other. It is a dangerous situation. Would that be helped by self-driving cars, a situation like that?
Yeah, because it really begins to regulate the speed of all the vehicles entering into that, and it will know what cars are being presented, you know, down below when you get onto that roadway.
And I think something that we may see before self-driving cars is connected vehicles, and this is a program that the U.S. DOT is really promoting where your car is emitting a radio signal, so you are always sending out a message saying, I'm here. And so if all the cars had that, they would be able to merge more smoothly because they would know a car is behind them.
When you talk about being kept track of, there is a certain segment of our population, and we talk about implementation and public policy, Dan, they will not like this. They don't want to be kept track of for various reasons. How do we tackle that?
Yeah, one of the big areas within the connected vehicle domain is computer security, cybersecurity, for exactly that reason. And typically on the policy end, those are the questions that they want to try to resolve on the front end in addition to working out the different kinds of communication strategies.
Here's a question. We go to break in just a minute or two, but this is a great question from in an email from Elizabeth. Would there still be a driving age for self-driving cars? Let's say my 10-year-old has a play date across town. I put him in the car. I program the car to take him there, and then he gets shuttled back here. Is that a vision of the future?
I think that's a terrific question. I think the way you sort of look at that kind of question is how you would look at other behaviors, whether you drop your kids off at the swimming pool, at other social activities where you think they're going to be monitored. I mean, certainly there's the possibility that you will get hit by somebody else. And do you want your child to be out there by themselves?
Mm-hmm. And also, you know, all technology malfunctions when at a certain point, and that would be very scary for a parent.
I think the bigger promise is at the other end of the age spectrum, where older people could continue having independent transportation way beyond the time when they would have stopped driving. And as our society ages, that's going to become a really big issue.
Mm-hmm. Imagine you send your kid off in a self-driving car and maybe there's a hacker out there that can the possibilities are endless. A lot of great novels in here, I think science fiction novels. We're talking about reality. Believe it or not, the self-driving car is here. Dan McGeehy is with us of the University of Iowa, Sue Kreisler as well, the University of Iowa. They'll be with us into the second half hour. Transportation is our focus. When we come back, we want to talk about marijuana and driving safety. Do you know how many drinks you can have and still be under the legal limit? What about marijuana if you're in a state that's legal as far as that goes? We'll talk about that when we come back. How to curb stoned driving, the hazards of all-terrain vehicles as well. And we'll finish up the hour talking about boating safety. We're asking you, what pet peeves on the road do you wish we could find a technological fix for? Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, email us, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPR Talk. Back in just a minute. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Stay tuned tomorrow at this time, of course, our Friday News Buzz edition of this program. And among other things, we'll be talking with Toby Huss. He's a successful Hollywood actor. He's now in the new a new AMC series that will be premiering this weekend on Sunday. Today, we're talking about different facets of transportation. We looked into the future in our last half hour. In the future of this program, which lasts another half hour, we want to talk about marijuana and driving, also some of the other hazards, farming vehicle hazards, ATVs, and boating to wind up the hour. But carrying over from our first half hour, an excellent question I wanted to put to our guests, Dan McGeehy, of the University of Iowa, Sue Kreisler of the University of Iowa. When we talked about self-driving cars, we had a question from Larissa on our Facebook page. She asks, if I got into a crash while using a self-driving vehicle, would I be liable for damages, or would it be the responsibility of the manufacturer? How will self-driving cars change auto insurance policies? So all question of liability, Dan. How do you tackle that one? That has to be a huge public policy question.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think really there's a sort of a set of answers that go with that. I think one thing to keep in mind about automated vehicles and especially self-driving cars that they have an amazing amount of information that comes with them. Versus today when we drive, we don't have a lot of information when we have a crash. We have to spend a lot of money trying to measure skid marks and looking at sort of vagaries of the scene and relying on witnesses, whereas today's more advanced vehicles have an enormous amount of data, and especially the self-driving car has a 360-degree view that it's recording all the time. So it'll really be sort of the perfect set of data that go with that. And I think that's going to be incumbent on the manufacturers of these systems to immediately release those data so that, that people can look at those to really see who's at fault.
Mm-hmm. You could opt out of driving a self-driving car. You could for the foreseeable future. That would be an issue, wouldn't it, that not all people would want to do these? And we would assume that in the future, in 40 or 50 years, there would still be those people, wouldn't we?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's certainly a lot of people who really enjoy driving a car. But today we're sort of moving more into sort of the appliance side. Cars are much more appliances these days. We're not interested in changing our own oil in the car and so forth.
We were asking our listeners for the pet peeves on the road that they wish could have a technological fix. This one tweeted from Aaron, tweeted to IPR Talk, "I wish there was a tech fix for drivers who fail to use turn signals." Trying to imagine what that might be.
I actually think there could be a technology fix for that, both in terms of the car knowing that you're changing lanes, either through camera recognition of the lane markings, but also through recognition of your eye movements that would indicate your intent to change lanes.
Let's move on to another topic in the news that concerns driving, with marijuana for recreational or medical use becoming legal in more and more states, not in Iowa, with the exception of cannabis oil for certain medical conditions. Let's talk about driving under the influence of marijuana, the hazards of driving stoned. The Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa is conducting a study on the effects of marijuana on driving. Who can tell us about that, Sue?
Actually, National Advanced Driving Simulator is conducting the study.
Mm-hmm.
And we just finished it up, and this was funded by the National Institutes on Drug Abuse and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. And they're very interested in understanding the relationship between dosage. So as you said before the break, how much marijuana is equal to how much alcohol. We don't have the results of that study yet. We're actually still blinded to our conditions, so I should know soon.
What questions? What were the questions you were main ones you're looking at?
We had volunteers come in 6 times, and they had different levels of alcohol. And so each visit was a different combination of alcohol and marijuana. And we had placebo control, so there actually is marijuana that has the THC removed. So you still smoke it, but there actually isn't any psychoactive ingredient in it. We're working on a study right now that is evaluating some equipment that law enforcement may be able to use on the roadside with a quick kind of iPad behavioral test that would be diagnostic that you're under impairment. And if you'd like to volunteer, visit drivingstudies.com. We are currently recruiting, and there's more information there.
Do you know at this point, we know that when we learn about the problem with alcohol and driving is it reduces our reaction time. Mm-hmm. And affects our judgment as well. How does that compare with marijuana? Do we know that basic question?
Yeah. Drowsiness is a big issue with marijuana, more so than with alcohol, but also the same things. They're slower decision-making, a little bit slower thinking. The problem with a lot of the past research has been both the delivery method of the, you know, some they're sort of THC pills you can take. And so there's a lot of very different results out there, both in American research and internationally, somewhat due to the different dosages and even being able to control the potency of the marijuana that you're using.
Mm-hmm. What does the law say about driving with any influence of marijuana now?
I'm not entirely certain what it is in Iowa at the moment. I mean, they need to do blood testing currently, which is, you know, a whole next level of enforcement. Certainly in the states that have legal or decriminalized it, that's a big issue right now that they are trying to deal with, both in identifying impaired drivers. You know, like a law enforcement officer right now may be known as weaving, but we hope that the study that we just finished will help identify those behaviors that an officer might be able to spot on the road as a reason to pull someone over.
When will the results be known to you and made public?
I would say within probably 6 months, we'll meet with the agencies that funded it. And, you know, it was a relatively small study, but I think it's going to be indicative of what levels of marijuana may, you know, at least what blood levels of marijuana may correlate to what blood alcohol levels.
Sue Kreisler is Director of Research at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. Dan McGeehy is with us, Director of Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research at the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. Let's talk about the hazards posed by farming vehicles. You've no doubt encountered farm equipment this spring, planting during the planting season, if you've been driving in rural areas. I certainly have. Crashes involving farm equipment occur, I understand, quite frequently in the U.S. I want to explore that further with Dan and Sue, but also let me introduce Dr. Chuck Jennison, Clinical Associate Professor in Emergency Medicine at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. Dr. Jennison, welcome to our program.
Hi, Ben.
Let's give us a better idea of how serious this problem is. Who can tackle that question when we talk about the number of accidents that we see every year in rough terms, Dr. Jennison?
I know the most recent numbers, but for a while there, I think every third day on average we had a crash with a motor vehicle with an agricultural vehicle of some sort, like a tractor, and something like about five times greater risk for a death in a agricultural vehicle versus motor vehicle collision. So there's something that happens quite frequently here in Iowa for sure.
Mm-hmm. What is it? What is a typical scenario? What makes this so problematic? Farm equipment? I can guess it's moving at a much slower speed. Sue?
A lot of the crashes are left turn crashes where there may be some traffic, you know, lining up behind the slow-moving tractor and decide to start passing right at the time that the farmer wants to turn left into the driveway.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something for drivers to really be cautious of. If you're going to pass, make sure there's not a driveway off to the left coming up.
Mm-hmm. What are the ideas on how we reduce the number of accidents in this sector of driving?
Well, like Sue said, that's that kind of situation. Often even the vehicle, the tractor driver will kind of swing to the left, to the right a little bit before they take a left turn. And so a lot of times a vehicle driver behind thinks they're actually pulling to the side to let them pass, but they're actually getting ready to take a nice wide left turn into their driveway, to the field, or to their home. And as you mentioned, the slow-moving vehicle, people can come on those very quickly over a hill crest or something, and then all of a sudden the vehicle's in front of them. So I think the biggest thing is, as you know, we're starting to have homes more and more into rural areas outside of more urban centers. There, the mix of motor vehicles with agricultural vehicles increases, and so people with who build a home out in a rural area have to be aware of those vehicles and the risks that are there, and to prevent those crashes from happening.
We also sadly have news of more accidents involving all-terrain vehicles. This comes up every year. ATVs found a lot in rural areas, not just farmers, people working in agriculture, but people who live on the land. And this is a great form of recreation, especially for young people. But just this week, we learned that a six-year-old from Montezuma, Iowa, died following an all-terrain vehicle. Also, a two-year-old died this month. And I want to introduce Lauren O'Donnell, Injury Prevention and Community Outreach Coordinator at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. You see, sadly, a lot of injuries due to ATVs?
A very large amount.
Is it happen in the spring? People, I guess ATVs can be driven all seasons, huh?
Yep, mostly spring, summer, and fall.
Okay, so what are the typical types of injuries? What happens in these situations? Who can answer that question? Doctor?
Well, there's all different types of situations, unfortunately. The biggest killer on ATVs has been people driving on the road. In the United States, over 60% of all ATV fatalities have occurred on roadways. And here in Iowa, we've been about that same amount. About 57% of our deaths have been on roadways. So the probably the biggest thing to prevent a fatality is not to be driving on the road with an ATV. And if you do so, you know you're doing so at an increased risk for tragedy, really.
It may be sound like a self-evident question, but why so many children involved here? They do look like large toys, don't they?
Yes, and they are riding their parents' machines, which are much larger than what they should be riding. The biggest risk is when a kid's riding their parents' ATV, it means a bigger engine and more weight. And when those flip over, the kids aren't able to lift them off of themselves.
In fact, in this latest fatality of the six-year-old from Montezuma, I'm reading the report that the girl's father was driving the ATV and turned around after seeing some cattle, according to the Iowa State Patrol. Then stopped. The ATV rolled off the shoulder of the road and onto its side, and the girl was pinned underneath. So like a tractor, an ATV has considerable weight and can crush a person.
Yeah, in this particular case you're talking about, the actual it wasn't what we would really call an ATV. It was what we would call a UTV, a utility task vehicle. These vehicles actually have rollover protective structures and kind of look like a little Jeep. But they're not made for on-road use, and so the biggest problem we see with deaths with those is that the people that are in them are not restrained. So if you are not restrained in a UTV, it rolls over, you could be thrown, and then the vehicle lands on top of you. So you're not protected by that rollover protective structure if you don't have your seatbelt restraining device connected.
Mm-hmm. So where do we see the biggest gains here, the reduction in injuries and fatalities in ATVs or UTVs? Is it more a matter of education or making a vehicle safer itself, the manufacturer making it safer?
So a big part of this is going to, for children's, which we're particularly interested in, we have a safety education program we call the STARS program, Safety Tips for ATV Riders, that we go out to schools, sponsored by Kohl's Cares program, department stores. And we've been very successful in trying to educate children to drive a little bit safer and be aware of this. In those educational sessions, we think the people that we are reaching that may be most affected by it are those that are infrequent riders, those that don't ride very often. And this happens a lot. About half of the youth riders ride maybe just a few times a year, usually when they're at somebody else's home.
The city kid goes out to the rural kid's pasture, drives around on an ATV, says, hey, great, this is great. And then because they're not acquainted with the power of the vehicle, how to operate it, you're shaking your head yes, Lauren.
Yes. They don't know that you're not supposed to ride with a helmet on, not supposed to ride with more than one person on it. They don't know that you're supposed to stay off the road. Those tires are made completely different than road tires. And they don't know the size of the machine that they're dealing with and the power.
Okay, so to close this conversation, advice to parents?
Well, we know that parents are allowing their children on ATVs. They should really not be on adult-sized vehicles. We want to make certain that if parents are allowing their children to ride them, they do so as carefully as possible. No passengers, as Lauren said, riding with a helmet, not on the road. These are really important things. And really supervising, make certain that the kids are driving them correctly. And if they're not, take that right to ride that ATV away from them. The biggest thing is it really shouldn't be on the road. That's the biggest killer of kids, and we need to keep them off of the road.
Dr. Chuck Jennison, thank you very much, of the University of Iowa. Lauren O'Donnell of the University of Iowa Children's Hospital, thank you. Also, thanks to Dan McGeehy of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa, where he's Director of Human Factors and Vehicle Safety Research, and Sue Kreisler, Director of Research at the National Advanced Driving Simulator at the University of Iowa. Fascinating conversation. Thank you for bringing up these concerns and a look into the future of driving. Thank you.
Thank you.
In the final few minutes, we want to talk about moving to off the roads onto water. The Iowa DNR is pushing increased water patrols this summer. It's part of an attempt to crack down on intoxicated boaters. Joining us in our Des Moines studio, Aaron Arthur, conservation officer with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hi, Aaron.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We got new laws in place just a couple of years ago, which lowered the alcohol level down to where you're in violation. It's the same as a driver, right?
Correct. Yep. It went from 0.10 down to 0.08, just like it is in motor vehicles on the road in 2011.
Nevertheless, how serious is the problem of intoxicated boaters in Iowa still?
It's always a problem. You know, you go out on the water and people, you know, they can have an open container in the boat, so they think drinking's okay, but it becomes a problem. We like to see people, if they're going to drink in boat, make sure they have a designated boat operator. That way there's no issues and everybody gets home safe.
Mm-hmm. Now, there were increased patrols starting this spring, this summer. We had a Memorial Day weekend last weekend. What did you gain from those increased patrols? Did you net more offenders?
With the DNR, we have a seasonal program where we bring on 45 additional water patrol officers in the summer to patrol the lakes to help enforcement of the boating regulations. With our big campaign of boating while intoxicated that we've been doing the last several years, there's a new program that we do the weekend before 4th of July. It's called Operation Dry Water. It's a national program put on by the National Boating Law Administrators, and all the states participate in it, strictly looking for intoxicated operators because, you know, if they get off the water, they're operating intoxicated on the water, but then they're also operating intoxicated once they make it onto the road, and I'd rather stop them from making anywhere if they're intoxicated.
Mm-hmm. Where does this misperception come from, that you're less dangerous if you're driving a boat while intoxicated than driving a car?
Well, I'm not sure where it comes from. I think maybe it comes from the fact that, you know, legally you can't have an open container in a car, but then you can go out in a boat and do it. So some people think that it's not that big of an issue. But quite honestly, you're dealing with a lot more factors when you're driving a boat because, you know, there's no lanes on the lake. There's wind, waves, all these other extra factors that you really don't have to deal with when you're in a motor vehicle. So, you know, boats don't have brakes. You have to have a better reaction time. Boats just don't stop on a dime. So, quite honestly, they're probably more complicated to drive than a motor vehicle.
Mm-hmm. And I suppose also cars we associate with all kinds of pursuits. Mm-hmm. You know, we travel, of course, to work. But boats are, at least in this part of the world, primarily for recreation.
Recreation and the seasonal. You know, you drive your car year-round where you don't always operate your boat year-round, so you might not be as skilled as driving a boat. And when you mix alcohol and these other outdoor factors of sun and wind and wave action, you know, it can really slow your reaction time if you're not good at driving a boat.
Do you have any statistics on what bodies of water in Iowa have the most arrests for driving while intoxicated?
Yes, sir. Polk County at Sailorville Lake in 2013 had the most arrests, followed by Coralville Reservoir over by Iowa City, the Mississippi River, and Okoboji.
Mm-hmm.
What
does that tell you these are recreational bodies of water?
Yep. They're recreational bodies of water that are located near large populations of people. So, of course, you're going to have a high amount of arrests there because you're going to have a lot of high use in those areas.
Mm-hmm. What happens? We have just a minute or so left, but I'm curious about what happens when you're pulled over. We know how you're pulled over with a police officer suspected of being intoxicated. What happens in the boat situation?
Oh, when we pull a boat over, you know, we find a reason to stop them, whether it's a registration violation or a boat operation violation. Go through and check all their safety equipment, make sure they have all their proper life jackets, fire extinguishers, all those good things. You know, see if they've been drinking, and then if they have, we have a new standard set of field sobriety tests that are seated, so we can actually bring the person into the boat and perform field sobriety right there and then.
With a breathalyzer or what?
Well, no, most people are probably used to there's a standing version where they have to do the walk and turn, the one leg stand.
Ooh, on wavy water, I would fail that one.
But we have a new one where it's seated, so they're
okay.
sitting down in your boat, and there's different tests we now perform that are approved by NHTSA.
Okay. So, Aaron Arthur, we have to go, but I want to make sure that you tell us how people can keep themselves up to date on the latest rules concerning boating and drinking. Where can people go?
I suggest they take a boater safety class. I'll educate you on a lot of the rules and regulations, and you know, that's what I can suggest.
Okay. Aaron Arthur, thanks for coming into our studio. Conservation officer with the Iowa DNR. We hope everybody's having a safe time boating. Keep those things in mind. Don't want to have more tragedies. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury and Lindsay Moon. John Pemble helped us out in Des Moines today. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Hope you'll tune in tomorrow for our News Buzz edition as we close out the week. Thanks for joining us.